6:14 now on this Wednesday morning, August 6th. It seems to me, having grown up here, that I always associate August, traditionally, if it's a normal summer, with more rain and earlier in the day, and that seems to be what we're getting this year so far. Some showers already popping up in different areas, so be aware of that. Be careful if you're driving around. And remember, the state law says, and you might see the sign saying this, that if your wipers are on, your headlights have to be on. Okay, that's the state law. And the other thing is no flashers unless you're stopped. All right? 504-260-1870. That's Oakland Art Jeweler talking text line. If there's anything you want to share with us, no texting and driving. We've been talking about healthcare costs, and we thought we'd talk to Patrick Penfield, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University, about tariffs and prescription drug prices and more. How you doing, Patrick?
Good, Tommy. How are you?
I'm okay. Let's talk about tariffs on drugs, because we've been talking the last couple of days, as I said, about healthcare prices and how insurance is likely to go up. When it comes to prescription drugs, as I understand it from the people we've spoken to, we pay more here in the United States because the research is done here. I don't understand why we pay more. I thought I did, but I think the research is done here, but then other nations negotiate prices with drug companies. The United States doesn't. But what we're talking about here are drugs that are just manufactured somewhere else, correct?
Yeah, you're absolutely correct, Tommy. I mean, we do manufacture drugs here in the States, but most of our drugs are imported.
And why is that?
Cheaper. So less costs, less regulations, less labor costs. So, you know, for the pharmaceutical companies and the medical device companies, it's just less expensive, you know, to actually produce their goods overseas.
So let's talk about tariffs. What is the president proposing?
So the president's proposing an initial tariff. I think it's a small tariff, and then it's going to kick up to 150%, and then I think a year later up to 250%. So he really wants, you know, the medical device manufacturers and the pharmaceutical companies to start producing here in the United States.
So what would that look like, and how quickly could something like that happen logistically?
That'll take years, and that's just because, you know, you have to build a facility, you have to expand facilities, you have to order equipment, you have to, you know, get your supply chain in order. So it's not something that can happen overnight. So I think the president is trying to kind of phase that in, you know, to get, you know, the pharma companies and the medical device companies to produce here in the States. And actually, Tommy, I'm a proponent of that. My preference is for, you know, these pharmaceutical companies and medical device companies to produce in the United States more from a quality standpoint because, again, sometimes, you know, stuff that we bring in overseas is, you know, a little suspect as far as, you know, the quality of what we're receiving. And we've seen issues and problems before, eye drops and, you know, all these other situations that happen when you import drugs and there's no oversight.
And that goes to the inspection of the facilities, right? And who has the right to inspect them?
Yeah, so the FDA does, and it's
in
more difficult for them. Well, they can, but again, very difficult to do so. Mm-hmm. So, you know, it's pretty lax, and I think that's what a lot of Americans don't know is, you know, a lot of that stuff that comes over is, you know, it's not tested. And so, again, you're at the kind of the mercy of, you know, whoever's bringing this stuff in. So the FDA does do inspections overseas, but not to the extent that they do here in the States.
And like you, Patrick, I'm all for it being manufactured here. However, from what I understand, about 10% of the healthcare costs in this country come from prescription drugs. And if you put a big tariff on that, the question is who's going to eat the tariff? Because unlike other products, I would think in this case, because the drug manufacturers, and I guess we've got to draw a line between generic and patented patented drugs, are making big money, so maybe they could eat the tariffs. Take me through all of this.
Yeah, so what will happen is that prices will go up, you know, for pharmaceutical and medical devices. And so, and Tommy, your listeners may know this, may not, but so when a drug comes off patent, the drug companies automatically increase the price that last year. So the price, you know, dramatically goes up, which is kind of shocking. And then once it goes generic, that means that other companies can produce it because they, you know, the recipe is open and they can actually do that. Then usually the cost will drop dramatically. So, yeah, it's one of those things. It definitely, I think there is an issue there in regards to, you know, trying to control those costs. And, Tommy, the big thing for the drug companies and the medical device companies is just the cost of actually producing new drugs. So it's really expensive, and so they try to recoup that cost with a high price of drugs. However, it seems like that we do pay more here in the States than other countries, which doesn't make sense to me.
So if we're talking about 100 to 250% tariff, who's going to wind up eating it? That's my concern.
Tommy, the consumer, yeah. So your listeners, ourselves, you and me, we will be paying more for those, you know, those particular goods. The only way that you can is if somehow you have some type of controlled pricing, you know, with drugs. And that's something that the Trump administration can do. They can do their investigation. I think they are, doing that right now. But there's no reason why the United States should be paying more for drugs than other countries. That doesn't make sense, and that's not right.
It would seem like if you are going to do tariffs, you would have to put some kind of price controls on the drugs like Canada does, or negotiate prices or something like that, because otherwise it seems like a double-edged thing. Either people aren't going to be able to afford the medicine, or companies are going to have to pay more in insurance benefits, which means that ultimately gets cost passed along to us. Or when it comes to Medicaid, the federal government will be paying tariffs into the U.S. Treasury, right, if they pay for drugs?
Yeah. Tommy, you're absolutely correct. Yeah, so there has to be some type of price controls enacted by the Trump administration, you know, once they start really ramping up and escalating these tariffs against these pharmaceutical companies.
I know we didn't invite you on to talk about that, but that was in the news. So I thought I'd ask you about it. We'll talk about, generally speaking, tariffs taking shape. The president says that the import taxes will make America great and rich, making the country once again the most respected country anywhere in the world, ushering in a golden age. Do the numbers bear that out, or do we even know yet? 621 traffic now, WWL. 626, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Patrick Penfield, professor of supply chain practice at Syracuse University, about tariffs and the effect on the economy. We've already discussed prescription drug prices because that's in the news, and Patrick's given us a pretty good explanation of how all of that works and how tariffs would not be a bad thing, or at least how the drug should be manufactured here in this country. And I guess the question is, Patrick, how likely is that to happen?
It's going to take time, and so it'll probably be, you know, it could take as long as a decade. I mean, and that's just, again, you know, just trying to bring back stuff that we've outsourced and trying to get the supply chains all set up and build the factories. So, yeah, it's going to be a long, cumbersome process without a doubt.
So along those lines, what effect have tariffs had on the supply chain, if any?
Well, it's been brutal. So unfortunately, you know, if you look at the tariff rates, and the next tariff is 8-7 tomorrow is when it's supposed to be enacted. You're looking at 10 to 41% tariff rates across the board, you know, with all countries. So, you know, the budget lab at Yale did this analysis, and they said overall the impact will be 18.3%, and that's the highest since 1934.
Wait, say that part again?
Yeah, so the overall impact of tariffs, 18.3%. That's how much the tariff rate is. So when President Trump came into office, it was 2 to 3%. Mm-hmm. So you're talking about a 15% tax. You know, that's been enacted on anything that's been imported, that's being imported overall. So, unfortunately, Tommy, that is not good from a cost standpoint. That means costs are going up, and they have been going up, and they'll go up even more in the second half of this year.
So, again, $150 billion raised for the U.S. Treasury. The question is, where'd that money come from? Right?
Right. It's all those businesses that were importing materials. So I think the other thing, Tommy, your listeners may know this, may not, there's 6 million small businesses out there in the United States. And unfortunately, you know, this is really difficult for them to absorb, you know, this type of tax. And that's really impacting their margins. And not only with small businesses, we're starting to see this with large companies like Ford, GM, Stellantis, you know, talking about billion-dollar losses.
So when it comes to the return of manufacturing to the country as far as the supply chain goes, have we seen any of that yet?
Limited. And so, again, this is one of those things, it's time. So probably the best analogy I can give you is, like, say, if you're a company and you built this puzzle and the puzzle's all set and you're happy and it looks beautiful, and then somebody comes over and just kicks it and just all the pieces are scattered, that's kind of what's going on with these companies. They're all trying to figure out, okay, we've got to redo our supply chains based off these tariffs. So, you know, it's math and simple math, but it's time and it's not easy. So, you know, a lot of times the negotiations are done thinking it'll be very simple, but when you look at these supply chains that these companies have, they're very complicated. They're interwoven. You know, they're global supply chains. And so, you know, there's, you know, these issues that happen, you know, with their suppliers, with their supplier, the supplier. So it's just maddening, you know, how, you know, difficult the supply chain can be for some of these big companies.
I don't know if you remember the show The Office or not, but at one point Michael Scott comes in all excited. He wants to adopt a baby. And Pam says, well, it might take 6 months. And he says, well, I'm not sure I want a baby in 6 months. And while that's funny in a way, I think it goes to tariffs, and that is because companies need to plan 5-10 years out to make capital investment to return manufacturing here, but yet they don't know what the climate's going to be like in 5 or 10 years, right? So how do you do that? I don't understand if I'm running a company how I can do that, because the next guy or woman, whoever it is, may not be tariff-friendly at all. And then,
I'm
back to being undercut by another country, right?
Exactly. So it's causing paralysis with these companies because they can't plan. So there's no certainty. They don't know exactly what to do and how to do things. All right. So they're just, again, trying to operate within, you know, what's going on. And that's the other thing, too, is the president keeps changing things. Right. So, you know, if he says, hey, here's what it is, it's set in stone, then you can plan from that. But, you know, if you keep changing things from month to month to month with different countries, then it just causes chaos.
Is there any way the U.S., I know we got to go to news here, but is there any way the U.S. could put a tariff plan in effect that will be there 10 years from now so companies could plan, or is that up to each president to do that?
It's up to each president. Right. Yeah, so it's not, yeah, it's that, exactly. You know, right. So you've got each president can do whatever they want.
Thank you. Thank you, Patrick. Appreciate your time. Not criticizing President Trump, but I would just ask y'all, if you're a company, how do you figure out whether you're going to return manufacturing here? Because if you return it here and then the next person takes tariffs off, then you're being undercut in Vietnam and other places, and all of a sudden you got a factory that's empty. We'll take a break, come back, talk about redistricting right now. A minute late, time for WWL First News. So that will go to Dave Cohen. 6:45, quarter till 7. We're into our regular, what I consider, August pattern, where it rains earlier and more often, and that's what's underway this morning and will be underway today and for the next several days. Tropics, though, nothing to affect us, so we'll take it. Dane Ciolino joins us now, our friend, Professor of Law at Loyola. How you doing, Dane?
Just fine, Tommy. How are you?
I'm fine. Let's talk about redistricting and as it relates to Louisiana, because apparently, obviously, it's got everybody's attention with what's going on in Texas. Does what's going on in Texas have anything to do with the redistricting case as it relates to Louisiana?
No. What is going on there is a legislative fight over redistricting, and those happen routinely. What's happening in Louisiana is quite odd, and it has the attention of constitutional law scholars and court watchers all over the country, because this case, at least the most recent action by the U.S. Supreme Court, possibly portends a significant change of course by the court with regard to the Voting Rights Act. And that's what's so intriguing about this. As you may remember, the big argument as these cases were going up to the U.S. Supreme Court was whether or not the state violated the Voting Rights Act by using race as a predominant factor in creating that second minority district. And that was the principal issue that was looked at by most of these courts. What the Supreme Court has signaled is that it wants to look at the bigger issue, that is, whether any effort to intentionally use race as a basis for drawing congressional districts violates the Equal Protection Clause of the United States Constitution. And if they find that, it will essentially gut, if not jurisprudentially, overrule the Voting Rights Act that's been in place for more than 40 years.
So the Voting Rights Act was initially designed to give minorities more of a voice or more equal representation. So it would seem as though by design it had to take race into consideration, but now they're saying that that's wrong. I'm confused, Dane.
Yeah, well, as you know, a couple of years ago, the U.S. Supreme Court said that using race as a basis for public school admissions and is something that that violates the Equal Protection Clause, because the court has taken a essentially a colorblind approach to college admissions. And that decision is one that is playing out in other areas now, in just general employment and in government funding and those sorts of things. A lot of the, you know, DVE and DEI type programs that were government sponsored are in peril now. Well, this is just yet another variation on that theme with the court's most recent framing of the issue that it's going to take up in October, which is, can you intentionally use race at all in drawing these congressional districts? And I don't think anybody doubts that's exactly what Louisiana did, although certainly arguments were made that this was all about preserving Mike Johnson's seat and running Garrett Graves out of Washington. It clearly used race, and anybody who suggests otherwise is not being completely honest with
you. So, but I guess what I can't understand is, how would that be illegal if the Voting Rights Act was about race, using race, was it not?
Yeah, it was. And the court, in a case called Jingles that you've probably heard people talk about over the past couple of years, said that you could use race, but it couldn't be a predominant factor. Other things needed to matter, like how close together all the constituents were, how what did the district look like, a snake snaking through the state rather than something more of a block with everyone hanging together geographically. But if this court does what it looks like it's going to do, if race is intentionally used as a factor at all, it's going to violate the Equal Protection Clause, which again, if that's the ruling that comes out of the court after the oral arguments in October, that is essentially a huge shift in policy.
Now, let me take a break. We'll pick it up when we come back. Dane, as you well know, I have a keen legal mind, at least in my own mind. And I'm thinking that one of the arguments here would be that, well, if you're going to base it on race, you're presuming that all people of the same race are going to vote the same way, right? Because otherwise you're saying that why else would it matter? At least that, to me, would be the presumption. 651, 9 till 7, traffic now, WWL. 657, 3 till 7, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola. If you'll notice, Dane, we turn your audio down as I proclaim myself to have one of the more brilliant legal minds in the country, because I didn't want any feedback about you from that. But anyway, let's talk about when it comes to if you're going to use race, and going back to the Voting Rights Act, I'll make a couple of statements. It would seem as though, A, if I'm arguing against it, I would say that you're presuming that all people of a certain race are going to vote the same way, because otherwise there's no argument when it comes to diluting their voting strength, right?
Yeah, I mean, I guess you're right. That is one of the underlying assumptions there, is that in order to represent minority interests, you need to have minority public servants that their interests aren't represented by people of a different race as well as they would be by someone of the same race.
And I guess the other thing that would come up is the Voting Rights Act was 1964. I got that right?
Correct.
So have things changed since 1964 where protections like that are no longer necessary? Yes or no?
Well, certainly attitudes toward so-called affirmative action have changed politically, but more importantly for our discussion, the changes in the United States Supreme Court over the last 5 or 6 years with the Trump appointees giving the conservatives, so-called conservatives, a 6-3 majority. And that majority has shown very little tolerance for racial preferences in a number of contexts. And now in the context of districting and redistricting congressional districts, we're going to see in October whether the court is going to tolerate race-based policies under the Voting Rights Act.
You think they'll go like they did with Alabama or not?
No, I think given that we know they've got four justices who have voted in favor of reframing the issues to present this as a clear shot at the Voting Rights Act using the Equal Protection Clause of the 14th Amendment. I think there's only they only need one more vote to do it. And my guess is they have it, and we're going to see this Louisiana district be declared unconstitutional in violation of the Equal Protection Clause.
Thank you, Dane. Appreciate your time and insight as always. Dane Cialino, professor of law at Loyola, who always tolerates his fool gladly. We'll talk about bike safety when we come back.